5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Okay, welcome into Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. I'm Elissa Walker-Campbell. We want to welcome all of our listeners tonight. A very happy July 4th, and we are so thrilled that you have made it a point to be with us. As promised, we have got another outstanding lineup over the next 2 hours, and in our very first conversation, we are heading to Dallas. We want to get the pulse on Carmelo Anthony, his meeting with the Mavs on Wednesday, and we're going to visit with the radio play-by-play announcer for the Dallas Mavericks, and that is Chuck Cooperstein. Happy July 4th, Chuck.
Happy, Alyssa. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. And free agency fever, it is underway. And Carmelo Anthony certainly highlights the 2014 class. Several teams this week made their pitch to Melo, one being the Dallas Mavericks. Can you give us a sense of the impression that the Mavericks made on Melo?
Well, since Melo's not talking, it's hard to say. He was in and out of town very quickly. It was a relatively short meeting compared to his meetings with Chicago and Houston, who I still believe are the two teams that are probably best positioned to land him. The Mavericks took a much different approach. They took a really nuts and bolts, meat and potatoes approach as opposed to the bells and whistles that both Chicago and Houston went through, and we'll see what matters to Carmelo, because if winning matters, the Mavericks and Rockets probably have better teams than Chicago does, but if it's all about getting to the final, and there's a lot to be said for that, you'd be nuts if you're Carmelo Anthony, LeBron James, or any high level free agent if you didn't really pursue action in the Eastern Conference, because the West right now is just so ridiculously loaded, and it's only going to be more so next year.
Okay, so take us some more behind the scenes and flesh out the details. What do you think the Dallas Mavericks, their main theme was with their pitch, with their presentation, and why Carmelo, why he should come to Dallas?
Well, number one, it's stable ownership. Mark Cuban's been the owner since January of 2000. They've made the playoffs 13 out of 14 years. They obviously have a championship. They obviously have taken care of, they take care of their players. They were way ahead of the curve, when it comes to, the amenities that players are looking for. You've got a championship level coach who I think certainly in this year's playoffs, if he hadn't already raised his profile to a ridiculously high level, officially did that in Rick Carlisle, and you'd be playing with the most selfless of superstars in Dirk Nowitzki, who is very open in saying, "Hey, if Carmelo wants to come here, he's got the key to the city. He's got the key to the team. I'm willing to step aside." And listen, that's what the Mavericks have been trying to do for the last couple of years, is try to have someone in here that would allow Dirk to take, I don't want to say a back seat, but more of a side seat, if you will, so that he doesn't have to do all of the heavy lifting now that he's turned 36 years old.
The radio voice for the Dallas Mavericks, Chuck Cooperstein, joining us tonight at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. You bring up Dirk, and I have to love that he is a part of the process to recruit Carmelo, his total commitment, his continued leadership. But, if Carmelo was to come on board, just think, he wouldn't have to be the recipient of any more Dirk daggers. I mean, that buzzer beater back in the month of February, I mean, that was heartbreaking for Carmelo, and he was all over Dirk when one flick of the wrist had changed the whole outcome of that game.
Yeah, it will be pretty interesting if you had a front line of Carmelo, Tyson Chandler, and Dirk. I mean, that would be a classic front line, as certainly as good an offensive front line, and you know, clearly with Chandler and Dirk and the relationship they have that you know that they forged from 2011, you know, bringing in a guy like Anthony into the mix, and then you obviously have Monte Ellis here for another year, you know, coming off of arguably his best all around year in the NBA, and that's a pretty formidable group to go into NBA battle with. You know, the downside of all this with Anthony is if he did sign with the Mavericks, and so much depends on the money that he ultimately would accept, you know, does he give the Mavericks enough room to be able to, you know, put the necessary feeder parts around him? You know, the Mavericks are in desperate need of a point guard. You know, they did get Raymond Felton back in the Chandler trade, but, you know, Devin Harris is free. The market for free agents has really kind of been established with the signing of Sean Livingston by Golden State and Derek Collison by Sacramento. That's sort of $5 million a year. Well, you know, Devin was looking for $3 million a year, you know, when this all started. But the market being what it is, he's thinking, hey, you know, I'm probably worth a little bit, at least that, or slightly less than that. How does that affect the Mavericks? You know, when you're in the salary cap world, every penny counts. And so that you know really becomes important in trying to build the team that's good enough to be able to get out of treacherous isn't even a strong enough word to decide you know to describe what the Western Conference is. It's just a gauntlet. It's just a complete gauntlet that you have to go through, and you need to be able to put a team together that can survive all that and then get yourself in the playoffs and hopefully spend 2 months there.
So, Chuck, from a financial standpoint, what would it take to get Carmelo to sign on that dotted line? What kind of contract do you think Dallas would be willing to offer him?
Well, they've already said they don't want to offer him the max, and I don't think that either Chicago or Houston will offer him the max either. A lot depends then on, you know, the kind of contract that Dirk is willing to accept. I mean, I think, you know, in any case, you're probably starting somewhere in the $17, $18 million a year range. And then, you know, you get the 4.5% raise every year, and then he gets a 4-year deal, you know, from that point. And then the Mavericks can try to, you know, take care of Dirk, and there's some salary cap gymnastics that I'm sure that, Donnie Nelson and Keith Grant and Jason White and the Mavericks staff are really, really good at that they would have to, I think, to employ to, you know, take care not only of Dirk, but really to fill out the rest of the team. But I think in any of the cases, whether it's Houston, Chicago, or the Mavericks, you're probably looking at, you know, somewhere between $17 to $18 million a year to start. Of course, the Lakers, you know, can offer the absolute most money, at least of the non-New York teams, because they can offer him a full max extension, and obviously the Knicks can as well.
It is time to take our first commercial break, and we will be rejoined with the radio voice of the Dallas Mavericks, Chuck Cooperstein, right here at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show, and join us online at Twitter, at E-Radio Sports. The radio voice for the Dallas Mavericks, Chuck Cooperstein, joining us tonight at YSR, the Big E Sports Show. So let's talk some hypotheticals. If Carmelo was to come to Dallas, talk about the impact that he could have. He's a 7-time All-Star. He's a scoring machine. And let's not forget the Mavericks this past season. They were, again, one of the best offensive teams in the NBA. He certainly adds another element of scoring.
Well, there is there is no better offensive coach in the NBA than Rick Carlisle, as far as I'm concerned. And the ability to create space on the floor has just become so paramount in today's NBA. And Rick is so good at it. If you get somebody like Anthony, who is a terrific mid-range shooter, you know, who you can also post up, you know, Dirk, who you can also post up, but you know, Dirk would rather, you know, shoot from the elbow. When you have multiple ways to attack, you become that much more difficult to defend. So, you know, from an offensive standpoint, they would be terrific. Defensively, Anthony has never been, I would say, a terribly willing defender, but I think, you know, what happens in the NBA oftentimes is that, you know, guys are asked to concentrate on one end of the floor or the other. You always hear the line from coaches, especially when they're dealing with great players, we want to make them play defense because defense is hard work. So, the Mavericks, I think, are good, are better defensively right now simply because of the presence of Chandler and the fact that he comes into this team without an adjustment period because he knows the defense. He knows the calls. He knows where guys are supposed to be on the floor. So they've got a big head start over where they were even in 2011, you know, or the 2010-2011 season when, you know, they had come off a 55-win season and a second seed, but lost in the first round to San Antonio. I mean, in some ways, they're really ahead of the game. So, I mean, there's a lot of possibility. I mean, clearly, if Anthony shows up, then, you know, we'll just wait and see. If he does, you know, it certainly would be a first for the Mavericks in the free agent era if they were able to do that.
Chuck, can you provide some insight, though, on defensively what Carmelo Anthony, what he would bring? Because you spent a lot of time around Rick Carlisle, and he's always talking about good defense is the precursor to better offense. I mean, he's got to be able to absorb that part and that portion of a Coach Carlisle system. It's paramount.
Well, I think he can do that. Now, he's not going to be Sean Marion. I mean, and certainly Sean Marion is prime. I mean, that's not who he is. I mean, he's much more of an offensive threat than Marion is. And, you know, as much as you talk about good defense, as much as Rick does talk about good defense, you know, there are sometimes you just have to play the hand that's dealt you. And, you know, as I said, it's not as if he's going to be unwilling at that end of the floor. I think he does have something to prove, regardless of where he winds up. You know, he's a very good rebounder. And, you know, the Mavericks have needed their small forward, Marion, over the last 5 years to be a really good rebounder. He's a very good rebounder for his size. He's got good size. I mean, he's about 6'8", and he's about 235. Uh-huh. I mean, it's not like he's, you know, a skinny guy. I mean, he can bang if he has to bang. You know, you'd like to limit it as much as you can, but he can certainly do that. I mean, but, you know, are the Mavericks going to be a great defensive team with Carmelo Anthony? No, they're not. But, you know, in this league, it seems pretty clear, you know, there aren't very many teams that have won championships since 1980. I believe there are only 9 of them that have. And you basically, in this league, you win with stars. And Carmelo Anthony's a star. And Carmelo Anthony has shown, especially in his stint with USA Basketball, that when he's around other really good players, that he really shines, that he plays his best basketball, that he's, you know, that he's very much, you know, a major cog in the wheel as opposed to being the wheel itself.
You're listening to the voice of the Dallas Mavericks, Chuck Cooperstein, tonight at YSR, the Big East Sports Show. And I have to think, Chuck, in my mind, what would really set apart Dallas and where they would stand alone is you're talking about having an elite coach like Rick Carlisle, his ability to bring out the best in players. We've seen that, whether it's been a Brandon Wright, but I point to Monte Ellis, just how he took his game to a completely different level. And I'm not talking about just offensively. We really did witness, I would say, a renewed commitment defensively. Would you agree?
To a certain degree.
Okay.
You know, when Monte would play within the framework of their defense, he was pretty good. But there are times when Monte likes to freelance and go for the steal and the big play.
Yeah.
And when he wouldn't make that play, well, then everything gets all out of sorts and you wind up a lot of times allowing easy baskets. You know, when he does play within the concept, he's pretty good. I mean, he's, you know, obviously he's quick. He's got quick hands. He can move his feet. But, you know, sometimes you gotta stay within what the defense is asking you to do and not try to, you know, always hit the home run. So, but I think you're right in the sense that he has gotten better, at least certainly, you know, there was a time, I think, at Golden State where he was really pretty good in that area and then it got away from him. And I think Rick kind of brought that back last year and, you know, we'll see what it's like going forward. But, you know, let's face it. Overall, this was not a very good defensive team at all last year. You know, they relied on the incredible efficiency of their offense. They were third in the league in offensive efficiency to get to 49 wins. It probably should have been a few more wins, but again, you know, they couldn't get a stop a lot of times when they needed to get a stop. And whether that's you know, being able to score you know, and not go silent the last 4 minutes of a game when you have a 17-point lead, or if it's just simply on the defensive end, being able to grab a rebound. If you had Carmelo Anthony to take care of one end and Tyson Chandler to take care of the other, mm-hmm. You're probably a better team.
Absolutely. So what do you see as the biggest obstacle for Dallas to overcome in order to secure Carmelo?
I think it's Eastern Conference versus Western Conference.
Okay.
If Carmelo is really serious about winning, I think he's got to go to Chicago. You know, he can certainly get the most money in New York, but they're not going to win next year, and they're probably not going to win for a couple of years. And you know, does $30 million more, offset the fact that you're not going to be contending for championships. I mean, he's made plenty of money in his career. You know, it really is time for him to go win. It's a little different with guys earlier in their career when you're trying to build up your money, because that is pretty much how NBA players keep score, and frankly, how most professional athletes keep score, by how much money they make. But when you haven't won, really, when you've already made over $150 million in your career, what's the difference between $16 million a year and $19 million a year? Seriously. So, if he's really thinking about winning, if winning is the most important thing, and you're playing alongside Derrick Rose and Joakim Noah, I mean, that's a pretty dynamic threesome. And, you know, Jimmy Butler, I think, is one of the most underrated players in the league, and he fits in perfectly with Chicago. But they need scoring. I mean, Chicago struggles to score. I mean, Tom Thibodeau desperately needs a small forward. He lost the Wall Thing in the trade. He was devastated when that happened.
Right.
You know, they made a nice deal on draft night to get Doug McDermott, but, you know, he's not ready to be a man right now. He's certainly not that. But, you know, in concert with somebody like Carmelo Anthony at that position, at the small forward spot, that could be pretty devastating. There's only one team to beat right now in the Eastern Conference. And assuming again that LeBron, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh all come back together in Miami, there's only one team to beat. And if those guys don't come back together, then maybe there isn't anybody to beat, given how Chicago played at the end of last year. So, I mean, it really is the path of least resistance, because in the end, when you win a championship, nobody ever asks you how you did it. They just look at the fact that you did. If you're looking for the better team to play with, I think you could certainly make a case for the Mavericks, and you might be able to make a case for the Rockets as well. But if it's about winning championships, I mean, you've got to get to the finals before you can even have a chance to win the championship. And the path is far smoother going through the East than it is through the West.
Okay, the great Chuck Cooperstein has been with us tonight at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. He is the radio voice for his Dallas Mavericks. Always a pleasure, Chuck. We sincerely appreciate you dropping by on this July 4th holiday. Be safe.
Thanks for having me, Alyssa. Take care.
You bet. Much more straight ahead this weekend at YSR. Okay, we are back with you at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. We want you to connect with us at Twitter at E Radio Sports. And we hope all of you tuning in tonight are enjoying your July 4th holiday. And it is hard to believe the start of the college football season. It is just around the corner. And this will be a season like no other, with the implementation of a four-team college football playoff and the BCS era finally comes to an end. We've got a lot to highlight in our next conversation with one of college football's very best to have ever been a part of the game, and that is Husker great, the double nickel, the great Jason Peter. Hello, Jason.
How you doing, E?
Hey, I'm doing great. Happy 4th of July to you. Big plans for the Peter family tonight?
No. Just hanging, hopefully, poolside, letting the kids run around, tire them out, and then hopefully to bed early.
Yeah, get out those sparklers, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, Jason, last week we were hoping that we would have a chance to discuss how schools right now, colleges are focusing on improving the college football experience. I guess apparently there's been a decline in attendance. Many folks are opting to stay at home, be a couch potato in front of that high-definition television. So it's creating a little bit of a challenge for universities to compete and try to draw fans back to stadiums. What are you seeing there in the Big Ten Conference? Can you talk about that?
Well, it's the same, I think, in the Big Ten as it is in all other college stadiums around the country. And that's, people want to be tied in to their social media while they're watching the game. And you're seeing it all over the place where they're all adding Wi-Fi and, you know, the jumbotrons that all these schools have. They're doing everything they can to keep seats or keep bodies in those seats. I mean, Nebraska, you know, it's certainly an issue up here, because the one record, I guess, that Nebraska kind of still holds is the consecutive sellout streaks. And it's, you know, I don't know exactly, it's 300-something consecutive games with a sellout, but there have been a few games where you look into the stands and, you know, you say to the guy next to you, did they just say that this was a sellout? Because it sure doesn't look like a sellout. You know, I think you have a lot of older people that have been dedicated fans for a long time, that they're tired of dealing with the at least $20 parking tab that they have to pay, having to deal with the traffic and everything else that goes along with getting to a game, the screaming Yahoos standing in front of you, the drunk guy to the right of you, and it never ends. And I think when you combine that with the flat screen TVs, the high definition TVs, people are saying to themselves, why should I deal with all of that when I can watch the game from the comfort of my own home, not have to deal with all that other stuff, and I can see the game maybe even better than if I was at the stadium. So it's this constant battle that these universities are dealing with, and that's just from the fan perspective. Then you talk about, the recruiting, because the 17-year-old kids eat this stuff up, the ribbon boards and the jumbotrons. I mean, Nebraska's got the big jumbotron at the one end of the stadium, and then they have four smaller ones in the corners. And they've kind of really been pioneers when it comes to the fan experience with the stadium renovations and what have you. But now everybody seems to be going down that same avenue.
Well, and Jason, that's what I was going to ask you. What are some of the changes and the upgrades that you have seen at the University of Nebraska? I mean, it's a much different experience for the fans than when you were a player there.
Absolutely. We had kind of the one screen at the end, which has now been replaced, and I think it was in 1994 they actually had two of the smaller screens in the corner, so that people, depending on where you sat in the stadium, there might be a few plays, depending on where the ball was, that you might not be able to see. So they wanted to make sure everybody could see, and every play was, put back up on the jumbotron for everybody to see. But, that was in 1994. And then when I came back, in late 2000s, it was just a different stadium. Like I said, on both sides, they have the ribbon boards. They've got, the four smaller screens. They've got the massive big jumbotron at the one end. But even with all of that, you couldn't text anybody, you couldn't, watch your Twitter feed, you couldn't comment and on the game, and that's what people do nowadays. I mean, everybody has a voice, right? Everybody's a coach. There are 80,000 coaches sitting in the stadium, and, half of them want to be able to get on their social media accounts and give everybody who maybe isn't at the game a play-by-play review of the game. And you weren't able to do that at Nebraska, and I'm sure there are many stadiums that were like that, but this year Nebraska has upgraded, and they've put in, some high-tech Wi-Fi deal, and just always trying to improve, like I said, the fan experience.
It is our weekly Under the Helmet segment with the great Jason Peter this weekend at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. We love hearing from you. Connect with us online at Twitter, at eRadioSports, and always visit our podcast page at yahoosportsradio.com/podcast. And right now we're focusing in on the fan experience. Jason, you said it best. Please boost the Wi-Fi. I mean, I've got to be able to access my Twitter account.
Right. Yeah. That's kind of, the world that we live in. It's funny because you could have a stadium full of 80,000 people, and, the people that they are basically, upgrading the stadium for, 90% of the time, they don't even have their head up. They have their head down because, they're looking at their phone, being able to text and tweet and do all that stuff. And You know, I don't know. It's just it's a different world where people, I guess, you know, they're more in tune with that stuff and being able to hear what other people are saying about the game, as opposed to just sitting there and watching the game with your buddies and you know, going back and forth and having human contact. You know, something that goes beyond football, I think.
I think
even as parents, mm-hmm. you know, with young children, that's something that you worry about. And I think you see it a lot nowadays where young kids, you know, teenagers, at least, you know, we're talking about 2014 now, you know, where you talk to these kids and they cannot look people in the eye. And that's because 90% of their life is the head is down and it's in the iPad or the iPhone or on the computer, and you know, that's just the way it is. But I think you know, a lot of kids maybe don't grow up with good, you know, person-to-person sort of skills, and I think it's pretty evident today.
Well, just about 60 seconds with Jason Peter and our weekly Under the Helmet segment. I think what's remarkable to watch, too, is just the renovation we're seeing across the country with so many stadiums. It's a big priority. We're even seeing that now at the University of Oklahoma. I had posted on my Twitter account their updated master plan, $370 million upgrade to their football stadium. I mean, the conceptual master plan, it is really, really remarkable. We're excited.
I thought that was all just for that Dorian Green Beckham, the wide receiver that they picked up from Missouri. I thought they were just improving the football stadium for him. But no, it everybody's doing it, and it's not you know, a $5 million project here, a $10 million project there. I mean, like you said, $370 million, and Oklahoma is in a long list of schools that are dedicating that kind of money to their football program.
Okay, Jason Peter's been with us tonight. Happy 4th of July, safe travels, and we'll talk to you again real soon. Thank you, Jay.
Thanks for having me.
Much more straight ahead at YSR. Okay, we are back inside the Quicken Loans studios at YSR and wishing all of our listeners tonight across the country a wonderful, a very safe July 4th holiday. It is time now for us to focus our attention on World Cup 2014. And unfortunately, the wild ride comes to an end for the United States. But I will say, after following Team USA, you've got to feel really good about their overall execution, their performance. It was truly a captivating run. It is such a pleasure to welcome back the New York Times columnist, that is George Vesey. He has covered the World Cup for over 30 years and recently released a book. It is titled 8 World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and the Dark Side of Soccer. Always an honor, George. How are you on this July 4th?
It's nice talking to you.
Well, you're certainly one of our heroes, and we always love to get your perspective on World Cup soccer. And unfortunately for the USA, their run comes to an end with that dramatic loss against Belgium. It certainly was tough to watch it come to a close. What surprised you the most about Team USA's run?
Well, they certainly, I can't say it surprised me, but they were gritty, and I was impressed by how they stuck with four teams. I thought they would lose in the first round. I thought they would somehow find a way to lose to Ghana for the third time, third straight World Cup, and then Portugal with the big guy, and then Germany, which I favored to win the tournament. I thought the U.S. might not get a single point out of it. But they found ways to win, to tie, and then to lose closely. They were admirable in all three matches, even when their best players got hurt, like Altidore, or didn't have particularly good games, like Michael Bradley. They still managed to gut it out. So as with any team, if you're deep enough and you work together, other guys filled in. This Jermaine Jones, who's German-American and not known as a scorer, he had a fantastic goal against Portugal, coming around a kind of a screen and just slashing the ball into the corner of the net. Other guys filled in, did what they had to do, and the U.S. was still in contention late into extra time against Belgium, which is quite admirable.
So many highlights, so many memorable moments, and a lot of emotion. What was your favorite?
My favorite? Well, I would certainly say that Jermaine Jones' goal in traffic against Portugal, because it really gave him. But then again, having the big kid come in the first match against Ghana, a guy named Brooks, his first World Cup appearance, he's German-American also, and he hasn't played much for the U.S., and he comes in and moves upfield for a header, even though he's a defender, where he's supposed to be on the headers, and he puts the ball in the goal. There were so many examples. And then finally, in the fourth match, they bring in a German-American kid named Julian Green, who basically had Landon Donovan's spot on the team. Now, everybody's been picking on Klinsmann, the coach, for favoring the German players and for bringing in guys and for not wanting Donovan. And I was critical, too. I thought it was a mistake. But here's the young fellow, 19 years old, taking Donovan's place, getting a chance to play. They're down 2-0. Suddenly, the thing is just about lost. And what does he do on his first touch ever in the World Cup but scores a goal on a volley? Mm. Just a gorgeous, deft touch on the ball. So even at that, you just have to smile and say, you know, they pretty much did a lot of right things. And even though they're not a great team and maybe not even a quarterfinal team yet, they can come home, the country will be proud of them. And then, to sum it up, you as a basketball player looking at your colleague, Tim Howard, in the goal, making 16 saves. This is a guy that could dunk, by the way.
Yeah, and he's 6'3", 210, and that certainly was my highlight when I watched this. Tim Howard, I mean, he certainly came to my mind. The fact 16 saves, I thought that he was absolutely brilliant, and that defense, it certainly was formidable.
Yeah. Well, you know, from my writing of the book, the first chapter is about Tim Howard and the Americans, how they manufactured that goal against Algeria in 2010 in South Africa. And I go into a whole basketball riff on that, where the U.S. brought in Bill Russell to their practice in Connecticut in 2010 before they headed to South Africa. And there's the old eagle with the beard, Bill Russell, kind of stalking around on the field, just being around there.
Yeah.
He's not the most extroverted guy if you've ever been around him, unless he wants to be.
Uh-huh.
But Tim Howard was following Bill Russell off the field, off the practice field. And Russell goes by, not looking left or right, just kind of looking off into the stars somewhere. And there's Howard. So I know him well enough. He's a great guy. He's just a terrific guy, great sense of humor. And I said to him, did you tell Russell that you could dunk on him? And Howard get this look. You've seen that look that he has sometimes when he's yelling at his defenders.
Sure.
You know, screaming at the defenders in front of him. He gets this wild look in his eye as if to say, are you crazy? But he knew that was a joke. Still, the point was that he was around Bill Russell. He had a little bit of exposure to a basketball player that he would have admired particularly because he was a dunking center in New Jersey. And a few weeks later, he makes one of the great outlet passes that you make in basketball all the time. And in soccer, only once a year does something like that turn out the way it did.
The great George Vesey is joining us tonight at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. We love hearing from you. Join us at Twitter at E Radio Sports, and always twice is nice. You can go back to our podcast at yahoosportsradio.com/podcast. Of course, George Vesey, he is a New York Times columnist and an author. He just referenced that, the title of his new book. We want to encourage you with all this soccer fever going on, get a copy of this book. It is titled 8 World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and the Dark Side of Soccer. And of course, Tim Howard, I mean, what Belgium had 38 attempts, and that was the most saves in any World Cup since the 60s. I mean, he made quite some history there, didn't he?
Yeah, 16 saves, meaning the ball was on goal, would have gone in if Howard didn't handle it right. And 16 is a huge number. I mean, sometimes you can see actually where a keeper doesn't make a save in 90 minutes. The shots are wide, or they veer away, or they're just not taken. But in this case, 16 balls would have gone in, and then one did go in, really not his fault. It was just a breakdown, dog-tired players, and good, fresh players for Belgium scoring the goal. This fellow they brought in, a guy named Lukaku, is a world-level forward, wasn't starting for reasons only the coach knew, came in the 90th minute, and imagine a great player who hasn't played, how fresh he's going to seem in the heat and humidity of Brazil. But he was just strong enough to run the field and make a goal.
Would you agree that the performance by the United States in this particular World Cup, it really had a different feel to it? It obviously created quite a buzz, and now there is such an enormous following. I mean, they've really got to build off of that.
Well, I want to say this, that I still think the best game I've ever seen the United States play was in 2002 in South Korea when they beat Mexico 2-0. Because of the result, because of who the opposition was, and the fact that it was a shootout round of 16 match. They just totally humiliated Mexico to the point where the captain, Rafa Marquez, who was the guy who made who got the yellow card against the Netherlands last week that got them knocked out. Rafa Marquez cold-cocked Kobe Jones with an elbow to the side of the head just for meanness, just because he was a bully who'd been embarrassed. Now, I think that was the best game I've ever seen the United States play, and that's now 12 years ago. Having said that, the games they played were all valiant. There was a lot of skill. What's different is it's not so much that this was a better team than 2002 or 94 or any of that, but that the United States was more receptive to it, that a whole generation has grown up playing the sport to some degree, but more important, watching it on television, reading about it on the Internet, playing the thumb game, the FIFA.com or whatever it's called, the electronic board game. And young people, I say young people, everybody's younger than me, but everybody is used to soccer a little bit more than they used to be. They're bringing more into it, so they're able to appreciate this run more probably than Americans could appreciate only 12 years ago what that team did in South Korea.
Well, there's a new generation of fans getting into the sport, but how would you summarize this World Cup and what we have seen so far? I mean, at times there's been exceptional teams that have struggled.
Well, I would say a good run, certainly good choices by Jurgen Klinsmann for all the second-guessing. The things that he did worked out pretty much. I can't think of anything that he stuck with that really went wrong, blew up in his face. Having said that, I don't know where the U.S. stands 4 years from now. A lot of it is going to be rebuilding. Obviously, the Donovan era is over, probably the Dempsey era. Who knows where Michael Bradley is going, unless he gets back some of the form that he did. So these German-American guys, are they the future? They can't be. They shouldn't be, even though it's fine for them to play on the team. What really is needed is to have a fresh cadre of young players who are now 16, 17, 18, 19, rushing to fill in the openings that will be developing in the next 4 years, players who are now maybe in junior soccer here or starting to go overseas on their own. But clearly 4 years is a long cycle, and it may very well be the players who should be starring in 20, gosh, where are we talking about, 2018 in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
We may not even know of them yet.
Okay, George, as I get ready to close out the interview, give me a quick hit. Who is your favorite to win it all?
My favorite was Germany, and I picked Germany then because I thought they had the strength and the mentality to come into Brazil and hold their own, and that's what I said.
Okay, George Vesey, New York Times columnist and author. The title of his book is 8 World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and the Dark Side of Soccer. Happy 4th. Thank you so much, George, for the time.
Good holiday.
Absolutely. Much more straight ahead at YSR.